So we're being tracked across the web on pretty much everything that we do. And of course, when we're posting on social media and things like that, we're choosing to share that information about us, but we're not necessarily aware of where that's going and where that's going to end up. When we started looking at this issue, we decided this isn't actually the fault of the people using the technology. This is the fault of the people building the technology who are trying to collect this data, to monetize this data, and are deliberately building in addictive and manipulative interfaces in order to get as much data out of you as they can.
Welcome to Digital Mindfulness. I'm your host, Lawrence Sampofo. Today on the show, we're here with the author and designer, Laura Kalbag. In this show, Laura discusses the importance of what she calls ethical data and design for companies, but also for people, and particularly in the ways that we can integrate this into our daily lives. But first of all, welcome to the show. Here in Digital Mindfulness, for over 3 years now, we've brought you the best teachers and thought leaders who teach you how to be your best self in an age where we might be digitally distracted and hyper-connected. If you're new to the show, then the best place to find out much more about us is to visit digitalmindfulness.net/about, where you can find some required listening podcasts where we discuss everything from becoming more focused to habit building, cyberbullying, behavioral design, and much, much more. So enjoy today's show with Laura Kalbag. Laura, thanks so much for being a part of Digital Mindfulness today. I'm really thrilled to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very thrilled to be joining you.
So Laura, I wonder if for the audience, if you just give a little bit of an introduction to yourself, and particularly how you came to be working on this amazing area of the web and ethics and data.
Well, I started out as a designer and I studied design and at school and everything, and went to art school, university, studied graphic communication, but I was always really into the web. I got into the web because I like the idea of it being so democratic in that anyone can start, anyone can sort of get cheap tools, a cheap machine, and build their own website. And I thought that was really cool. And so I started getting into it, just building websites for people, doing design and development, things like that. And I think I've always had a kind of distrust of free products. I always heard that old saying that if you're not paying for it, you're the product being sold. And so I was always a little bit wary. But when it came to the Snowden revelations and people started talking a lot about how governments were surveilling us, well, me and my partner, Aral, we were going, the governments are having help. They're actually getting all of this from the corporations. That's where they're getting all of this data from on the web. It's because the corporations are collecting it. Yeah. And so we started getting interested in what can we do about this? How can we stop this from happening? How can we create alternatives for people where they don't have to be spied on?
That's really interesting, because when the Snowden revelations came out, now people have had a chance to really think about them. They're really polarizing. You know, they really shift people into one camp or another in terms of whether national security details should be released or whether people should be surveyed. But it was really this event that led you to think more about how people can be more savvy with their data.
So we're being tracked across the web on pretty much everything that we do. And of course, when we're posting on social media and things like that, we're choosing to share that information about us, but we're not necessarily aware of where that's going and where that's going to end up. And so when we started looking at this issue, we decided this isn't actually the fault of the people using the technology. This is the fault of the people building the technology who are trying to collect this data, to monetize this data, and are deliberately building in addictive and manipulative interfaces in order to get as much data out of you as they can.
I mean, Laura, I totally agree with you that it is the fault of the engineers and the designers and the companies who build these environments to collect all of this data so that it can be monetized, but also it's the economic incentive that this data is just very, very valuable and that these environments will be built to capitalize on that.
Yeah, well, it's the business model. It's because the web didn't have an obvious business model. So people were putting up content and on the early web, looking at sites and going, right, well, how do we make money from this? Well, what do newspapers and magazines do? They put ads next to the content. They make money that way. We'll try doing the same thing. But those ads weren't going to be clicked on by everyone. People weren't going to necessarily follow them. And so it became, well, how do we make these ads more targeted? How do we make sure people see our ads? And then that became adding more tracking and then finding that actually a lot of the time the ads themselves aren't providing the value, but the information that you can gain from the tracking is providing the value. And this wouldn't be so much of a problem if it hadn't become the mainstream business model of the web itself. It's the main way that any organization on the web makes money, is through monetizing data or advertising with behavioral advertising in one way or another. And so this is what Shoshana Zuboff coined as being called surveillance capitalism. This whole idea that all these businesses are making money from what is essentially surveillance. And the problem is that people aren't willing to explore alternative business models, and also that they are not interested in alternative business models because these data collecting models are so lucrative. Or if they do decide to have a subscription model or a sort of a service that you pay a one-off fee for, or an app or something like that, they think, well, why do I have to do that as an alternative to having the data? I'll do that and have the data as well.
So it was really these events that kind of led you to really think about this whole idea of ethical data. But for people that don't know, can you just explain what ethical data is and why it's so important?
Well, the focus is really on ethical design. And the idea is architecting the things that we build, the technology we build, be it an app, be it a website, be it a service, architect it in a way that we are not collecting data and that we are providing a service outside of collecting that data. Or if we want to build something that relies upon data and an individual's data, do so in a way that remains on their device and only their device. So you can provide fantastic insights using data, but you do so from within the device itself and you do not transmit any of it to your servers at any point.
That's super interesting. But Laura, do you have any examples of companies that are kind of putting ethical data into practice and doing it well?
Well, I think I'd say that they are not perfect by any means, but I think that Apple are trying to differentiate themselves on this in that they see that in terms of selling devices, Google's Android is their main competitor. And so they see that Google is making its money from monetizing data. And so it's in Apple's interest to not do that, because then they can use privacy as a differentiating factor between themselves and Google. And so they have been doing this, and they've been doing this in a way that the data that they collect about you remains on your device, or it's encrypted, sent like synced over iCloud or something like that. But at no point does Apple have access to that information outside of your device. So all of that information about you can be used to provide you recommendations, to sort of be used with algorithms, to sort of know where your house is and all of this stuff that Google also does, but does so in a way where that information is not shared with anybody else.
I think that that particular point is something that people are not very aware of, particularly because we use Android and iOS devices all the time. And of course, we use all of the apps and we interact with them and they generate data. But I don't think people are really aware of when they share their information, what happens to their data when they share it publicly and privately. So I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit more about that. What actually happens when we do generate and share data?
The problem is that anything could happen to that data. anything could happen to that information. And not just the information we think is valuable, is valuable. So we might, for example, think, oh, I've taken a naked photo of myself and sent it to my partner. I've uploaded it to a site somewhere in order that I can send it to my partner. I really want to keep that private between me and my partner, but I know what I'm doing, and I'm going to keep all of that information like secure, because we don't want that information to get out.
Yeah.
But what we might not realize is that the information that can be gathered from that photo is not just the contents of the photo itself or facial tracking or something like that, but even the information about the image, things that are stored in an image, like when it was taken, the location of where it was taken. If you think about all of this metadata, all of this other information that comes with a particular piece of content, that is incredibly valuable data, to the point where the NSA in the US, their security agency, they actually have systems. One of the ones that Snowden exposed was sucking up information about everyone in order to be able to decide, I don't know, who's a terrorist, predict terrorist attacks, stuff like that. That's what they say. There was actually an alternative to that being built by a guy called Bill Binney, who happens to be another whistleblower. And Bill Binney was actually collecting the metadata, because he said that if you collect all the information about everybody, you're searching for a needle in a haystack. You're trying to find something tiny in such a huge amount of information. Whereas actually the most valuable information can be gathered from the metadata. And so from things like when something was sent, sort of what time was a communication and who was it between, those kinds of things can be used with all sorts of clever algorithms to predict events and movements of people and things like that. And so actually, whereas we might think that the value of something that we're sharing or uploading is actually in the content for us, the metadata itself even is incredibly valuable, to the point where someone tracking the location on your device, a site might sort of, when you open it, might hit where your location is. If that is doing it and someone else you know has it happening on their phone as well, it could connect, it could know who you're sleeping next to. It could know who you're hanging out with. And so there's so much more value that can be taken from that data. And I say that very much in a, that's a bad thing, it's a scary thing, because we have no idea the extent to which we can be tracked and understood. They could probably have far more insight than we could gather on a personal basis by talking to each other and actually telling each other things.
This is fascinating, Laura, because, again, this is something that, you know, the average device holder, the average person, I don't think they have any idea about this. And so...
So, Laura, we've been speaking a lot about the role of companies and designers and engineers in building these environments that take our data, sequester it, and then make money from it. But what role do you think people actually have in being responsible for taking care of their data selves?
I think what people can do is try to find and support alternatives. So privacy-friendly alternatives, alternatives that do actually, that sort of have a specific business model that's not tracking, that can reassure you that you're not being tracked in any way. But I think that actually there's not that much that people can do, because companies out there are spending a huge amount of money on convincing you that they are doing it for your good, and that they are helping you, and that they are giving you wonderful things for free or wonderful things that you're paying for. And they're spending a lot of money and branding on doing that. And you can't help but be manipulated by that. I'm manipulated by that, and I know what I'm doing. And so I think what we really need to do is we need to get behind sort of regulating these practices, making sure that tracking cannot be as ubiquitous as it can. And the GDPR in the EU, that's going to go some way, the General Directive Privacy Regulation. But we also need to be able to support alternatives, because right now, if you say to someone, don't use Facebook, well, what are they going to do instead? There aren't a huge amount of options. And so what we need to do is we need to build these alternatives. We need to create these alternatives. And when you find an alternative, you need to vote for it with your money. You need to give it a reason to exist, give it sustainability by using it and recommending it to your friends and things like that. I mean, this is one of the reasons that we also built, we make a privacy tool that's called Better Blocker. And it's an iOS and Mac app. And what that does is it actually blocks trackers in the browser from tracking you. And the reason we built this was because we want to build alternatives, and we're working on sort of an architecture for technology that can't collect your data. But all the while that doesn't exist, we want to prevent the harms that are being caused by tracking, so that at least you have some peace of mind when you're browsing the web.
So, Laura, what would you say then to the idea that, you know, the collection, in addition to monetizing all of our data, that actually it's really useful in terms of, like, say, behavior design, that it is really useful that our data is captured and is analyzed without us knowing about it? For example, if our behavioral data is captured, say, by our wearable or whatever, and it can nudge us to being more active, or it can learn more about us to give us more a more personalized experience or products that we actually didn't know we wanted. What would you say to that? Isn't that useful?
So I'll take them both separately, because cool. I think they're two very different things. Mm. I think that we could and can use data in really interesting ways to provide insight to people and to help encourage people into good habits and things like that. I have an Apple Watch myself. I think I've pretty much used most of the early fitness trackers before I was more aware of this stuff. Because I love the idea of the quantified self. I love finding out information about my fitness. I love sort of comparing all of my different workouts and things like that. I think that's great. I think it's really useful. And I love it when I get information back that I couldn't possibly have derived myself. What we need to ensure is that all of those things are only being done on the devices themselves, and that that data is not going any further, that it's not being shared with anybody else, and that it's not being sold to anybody else, that it is benefiting the person who's providing it and nobody else. And so the person who's providing it can pay for it or things like that. And I think that's what individuals need to be aware of. I think in terms of whether data can be used in order to do things like prevent terrorist attacks and things like that, yes, of course, but there is different ways to collect it. Collecting everything about everyone is not going to provide any value, as I said before. Sort of specific targeted surveillance of people, sort of traditional policing, does work, and it's just a case of people, sort of police forces and things like that, understanding how to use technology. But I think that there's no reason to sort of stop breaking encryption and things like that, because breaking encryption is impossible, and we need encryption to protect us for banking and shopping and things like that. And so we have to find this balance of things that keep everybody safe on the web in general.
So, Laura, we've been talking a lot about all of the information that we would type into the web, or the images that we would share on social networks, etc. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the voice assistants that everyone's been in a craze to buy. Would you know much about those, and can you share that with us?
Well, I don't know what corporations are specifically doing with the data, because, of course, that's going to be a hugely well-guarded business secret. Of course, they'll use it to make better services and things like that. But the question is, what's the potential harm that there is to people using it? Because essentially, by getting some kind of voice assistant, you are putting a microphone in your house. And there's not much else to it, I think. Very few people would be comfortable with the idea that something could be listening to them at all times. And no, there's probably not a person sitting there specifically listening to you as an individual, But again, the amount that can be derived from what you're saying and what you're doing, the times at which you're doing it, when you're in your home, when you're not in your home, these things can be used against you. They can be used to manipulate you into buying things. People could go, oh, well, I know because you're out of the house at this particular time, but the rest of your family is in the house. You're spending a lot of time away from your family. And so maybe I'm selling some kind of product that I feel brings families together. So I'm going to use this information to try to target you as someone who is often away from their family to try to manipulate you into buying something. And we don't want that. We want to be able to have control over our information and how it's used. We need to be able to have that, because otherwise we start looking at issues like democracy being at risk because Facebook ads are being used in order to manipulate elections and referendums and things like that.
One of the arguments that I can see coming from this, Laura, is that people might say, well, you know, with these voice assistants, that of course there is a microphone in my house operating 24 hours a day, sending everything I say back to servers in the country that I don't know. But at the same time, I do need stuff. And having a company that can sift through all of the spam and serve me targeted ads is really useful for me, because I do need things, and having that personalized experience is better. But I think your argument to that argument might well be, that's totally fine if I agree to that, but all of that information then needs to be localized on the actual device.
Yes, I think if we're going to be sort of manipulated in any way, that should at least be going no further. Because, of course, the kinds of things that can be used in order to sell to us can be used in other ways. And I think a lot of us who are kind of working in the industry, we think about it from a very privileged point of view, because we're like, well, I haven't got anything to hide. But actually, if you look at people in other countries, in other societies, or actually even in the countries that we live in, information about ourselves that we might not currently regard as being dangerous could be dangerous in the future. So, for example, being gay in many countries is illegal.
Absolutely.
And I mean, in something like e-commerce, that could be a sort of a certain box that they decide to put you in because they can sell stuff to you. But actually, in other societies, that could be something that could get you severely hurt or killed. Being a particular ethnicity, I mean, you look at a huge amount of Europe right now is sort of teetering on the edge of having very far right racist governments. And so if these companies are essentially building databases where they know everybody's ethnicity and where they live, do you want that to get into the hands of a potentially fascist government? No, you really don't. And so the thing is that it's a thin end of the wedge situation where, yeah, sure, a little bit of data here and there might not cause any harm, but just look sort of a few years down the line and things could be incredibly different. And we know the rate of change is huge. And it's one of those things that if we start saying yes to it now, we're not going to have any fight to be able to say no to it later on. We're not going to have that upper hand.
So Laura, if you're a company now, or if you're someone now who creates digital experiences for people, what would you say the things that people should really be thinking about? What should be top of mind when you're really thinking about being ethical about people's data as they interact with your products and services?
I think it would be very savvy for companies to look at collecting as little data as possible, not just from an ethical perspective, but also the less you have, the less of vulnerability it is on your part, because the potential for being hacked, if you've had a huge amount of data, then you're a sort of a really good target if you're collecting a lot of information. And then you kind of have further sort of legal questions you would have to answer if you get to that point. So collecting data is something of a liability, and particularly if you're in an area that's going to be regulated, it's good to get ahead of this and to think about, how can I collect things in a way where I'm getting the bare minimum that I actually need to use? And not in a way where you rely on it for money, because legally, particularly in Europe, we are getting into that situation. And of course, this applies to anyone who has European customers, where it's going to be a complete liability collecting data, because the regulation will start cracking down on people that are that have collected data without explicit consent for explicit uses, and sort of being very specific. And nobody wants to provide a service where they're having to throw a dialogue box in every 10 seconds asking someone if they can collect this other little bit of information about them. And so it's not going to be a fun or useful thing anymore. It's not going to provide great experiences. And so we need to think about ways that we can do really clever things with data, but in a way that we don't have to have the liability of collecting it ourselves.
So Laura, you touched briefly upon this acronym GDPR, and which is a uniquely European piece of legislation protecting Europeans with data collection. But I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit, A, about that, but also about the role that you think governments have in helping to support the ethical use of data.
Oh, I think that in this sense, there are two very different kind of types of data. There's data and personal information of people, because really, you have someone's whole life if you have sort of data and personal information about them. But we have broader idea of data, and this is kind of data about sort of transportation, data about roads, data about the environment, and all of these things. That data is incredibly valuable to us as a society, and that kind of data should be open. That kind of data, we should be collecting loads of data about the world around us and be using it in ways in order to improve the world around us and improve societies as well. I think that's what governments should be doing. I mean, governments have to collect certain types of data in order to provide health services, in order to provide sort of do taxes and things like that. And what they are trying to do mostly is just keep that data secure. That's all they can do, and that's all they really should be doing, is collecting the bare minimum and keeping it secure. I don't think that any corporations should have any sort of be able to touch that data. I think that that should be government only data. I think all of these situations where our medical data is being shared with big corporations, I think that's incredibly dangerous, particularly outside of the country. So things like care.data that the UK was doing, where they were just sharing data with everyone who asked for it. We need to be very cautious. We need to understand the value of data in order to protect it.
So I think over and above everything that you've spoken about, Laura, this is just really a very hard problem. And I'm wondering what you would say, what would you recommend to people listening now about the ways that they can meaningfully look after and also go about their digitized lives and looking after their data selves?
Yeah, it's difficult. And so even taking me for an example, like I found myself posting less and less on social media. And it's not that it's anything that I don't, that I think is valuable, that I don't want to share. Like photos of me and photos of my dog aren't of huge amount of value. I mean, once there's one up there, there's not much damage to adding more. But really, it has made me more sort of cautious about it. And I think that this is really sad, because I think that we should, if we live in a world where being able to share things online is part of our new sort of social lives, this is how we interact with our friends a lot of the time, we shouldn't be punished for doing that. We shouldn't be punished for wanting to do that. We should have the things that support us in order to do that in a way that's safe for us. And so I think, first of all, people shouldn't blame themselves. I think that there's a lot of sort of victim blaming in the area of kind of going, well, you shouldn't be sharing this and you shouldn't be sharing that. No, we shouldn't blame ourselves, because we have no idea. But what we should do is try to be a little more cautious about the kind of services that we're using. I don't expect anyone to read privacy policies, because they're deliberately written to be confusing and they don't say explicitly what they do. but we should think about sort of instead of using Google search, use DuckDuckGo. Instead of using sort of Hotmail or Gmail, use an independent email provider. I mean, you might have to pay for it, but it's not a huge amount. I think if you have the ability to do so, then you should pay for these things, because otherwise we're not going to have any options left. We're everything will be free and we won't have any privacy whatsoever.
So, Laura, this is a question I ask everyone when they come onto the show, but I'm wondering, in this age where we're hyper-connected, what would you say are the most important human qualities and how do we cultivate those?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Especially in terms of interconnectedness, I think being a straightforward, honest person is a value, because if everyone can see you, I think it's nice to be able to present an authentic version of yourself. Mm. And because I think that that's very important for us as a society to grow, is understanding the richness of our diversity and how we all have our value because we are different. And that's what makes life so interesting.
It's interesting that you talk about authenticity, particularly in the digital age that we live in, because of course we can just present any version of ourselves that we choose to, and that ability to be authentic is something that people struggle with a lot, particularly when we know that our data is constantly being surveyed.
Yeah, well, and of course everyone projects a slightly shinier version of themselves, because you're likely to post pictures of your wonderful holiday abroad, but you're less likely to post pictures of the day I felt depressed and slept on the sofa all day and watched Netflix. So yeah. I think that's creating greater problems, in that portraying those things are leading each other to think, oh, that person's life's always amazing and is always like that, when that's not the case at all. And people are starting to have mental health issues because they don't see themselves as having these wonderful lives that everybody else has. And if we're manufacturing our lives, then it means nothing.
Absolutely.
I find it sad when people do sort of pose their lives in order for them to look good on social media. I hate it when I go to a gig and someone's holding a camera up taking pictures or taking video the whole time, because those pictures are never going to be any good. The sound quality on the video is always going to be awful. But you're missing out on the experience of being there in the moment. And that's such a shame.
So, Laura, I wonder if we can talk now about the work that you're doing at Indie, and particularly with the app that you've developed there called Better. Why is that so important and why should people really think about using that?
So we made Better because we saw there was so much tracking going on the web. We have this thing called the Inspector. And what it does is it goes through and it checks the top varying thousands amount of most popular websites in the world. And what it does is then go through and look at all of the scripts included on those websites and sees which companies are responsible for those scripts. So it's finding out all the different things that can possibly track you across the web. And so we saw what was going on because we're developers working on the web. And we were like, well, I don't want a lot of those things following me around. These are the things that are particularly causing stuff like those ads that follow you everywhere. So annoying things like that, as well as completely invisible things that are tracking us. And so we decided to make Better as a privacy tool to block as much of that tracking as we can. And so it will block a huge amount of, it's not an ad blocker. And so a lot of people, because we call it a blocker, will think it's an ad blocker. It actually works very similarly to an ad blocker, but we wouldn't block an ethical ad. And I say wouldn't because it's very hard to find ethical ads out there. And what I mean by an ethical ad is an ad that does not have tracking behind it. So if it were a picture or a bit of text that's advertising a thing with a link, that's totally fine. That's not invading anybody's privacy. But if it's got a tracking script behind it, we block that. And so we operate in a similar way to a lot of ad blockers, except that we block all tracking. Nobody can pay us to get through. We're not doing that. And we allow ethical advertising, people who are trying to make money and make sustainable businesses in a way that doesn't invade people's privacy. And we do that using the Apple's technology that they have called content blocking, which means very conveniently that we can affect what's going on in someone's browser, but we don't have any access to it ourselves, which means that we can give them a list of things to block, but we don't get to see anyone's web traffic, because it really would defeat the point if we were helping people with their privacy and then able to see everything they were doing on the web.
So, Laura, where can people find out more about you and your work and connect with you?
So I'm Laura Kalbag, which is K-A-L-B-A-G, and I'm pretty much that everywhere. You can, if you stick that in a search engine, there's no one else with the same name as me, so I'm pretty easy to find. And my organisation, which is me, my partner and our dog, is Indie, and our website is ind.ie. And Better Blocker, our app, that's at better.fyi.
Well, Laura, thanks so much for being on the show today. It's been a complete pleasure having you on, and I've learned a lot, so thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been really fun.